It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, June 18th, 2022. I'm Jared Halpern. A potential breakthrough on new gun safety legislation in Congress.
You're going to see it's going to be the largest investment towards mental health in our nation's history. And I think that's exactly what's needed.
I'm Kevin Cork. If you're like most Americans, the high price of gas is wreaking havoc on your budget. But have you ever wondered how on earth we ended up in this situation? Well, while the answers do vary and are decidedly complex in nature, one reason is a lack of oil refining capacity.
People take energy for granted when it's cheap. They assume that energy grows on trees. They don't understand the type of capital it takes to bring that gallon of gas to your gas station. But then when prices are high, they're all screaming, trying to point fingers, saying, boy, those evil oil companies or the oil refineries, they're driving up prices.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Is this time different? That question was asked often after a gunman entered Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas last month and killed 19 children and 2 teachers. We may have an answer next week. Early this week, 20 senators, 10 Democrats and 10 Republicans announced a framework agreement, not legislation, but an agreed upon set of proposals, enhancing background checks for gun buyers 18 to 21, closing a background check loophole for domestic abuse, federal grants for states with red flag laws, and funding for mental health resources and school safety. This week, the core group of negotiators in the Senate tried putting all of that into legislative text, making those ideas a bill that can become law. Some issues remain unresolved, but both sides say they are optimistic. And Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says if the legislation reflects the framework, he's on board. What about the House Republican who represents Uvalde? Congressman Tony Gonzalez says he has been talking about this framework with the lead Republican negotiator, Texas Senator John Cornyn. I spoke with Gonzalez about this framework and other steps Congress could take.
Yeah, we're still healing. And honestly, many of us have had to relive that day over and over again. It's day 22 after the incident occurred. And, you know, I'm getting calls every day. I'm getting emails every day. Folks really are just trying to live, trying to kind of piece their life back together and work through that. This is going to take a long process, not only for the families of the victims, but for honestly all the families in Uvalde. And it's not only Uvalde. Uvalde is really the big town, if you will, in that region. You know, it's the surrounding counties that feed into there as well. Everyone is impacted by it. Also, we're also trying to get ready for school. You know, it's about 60 plus days away, but it's not a lot of time. We got to get parents that feel comfortable dropping their kids off, get kids feeling comfortable going to school. Teachers, I was able to secure a $1.5 million grant to help with some of that. I appreciate Department of Education for being helpful with that, but we got a long way to go.
I want to talk a little bit about what's developing in the Senate. Have you had a chance to sort of look at this framework that was negotiated in part by Senator John Cornyn?
Yeah, of course. Look, Senator Cornyn and I have daily conversations, and we meet regularly on a wide variety of different topics. But I've been very involved with this framework. I look forward to seeing the finalized text and then going from there.
You know, when I traveled briefly to Uvalde when President Biden was there at the end of last month, and, you know, I'm sure you heard as well, as he left the mass service, there were people gathered who yelled, "Do something." Is that what this framework is? Is that sort of what you're hearing from constituents in Uvalde and in that part of Texas about, you know, steps that they think should be taken here by the federal government, by Congress?
Yeah, you know, I was at that mass with the president, and one of the most powerful parts of that mass was the father asked all the children in the church to come up. And there was 45 children that came up and sat there. And he said, he goes, look, you're going to be part of the healing because you're going to be, you're going to remind us that you're everything that that's pure in life and innocent. And so I think that's a reminder of what we have to focus on, our children, and making sure our children are taken care of. And really this package, the framework, it's not a gun package. It's a mental health package. You know, you're going to see it's going to be the largest investment towards mental health in our nation's history. And I think that's exactly what's needed. As far as Uvalde is concerned, it's a very conservative area. You know, it's split Republican and Democrat, but it's a conservative area. And I have many people telling me, very conservative gun owners and even gun manufacturers, going, Tony, I appreciate you voting against some of these anti-gun laws that have come before, but I know that's not the answer, but something is the answer, and I think this mental health package may lead us towards getting there.
You know, you call it a mental health package, and Democrats have said as much too, that this is a lot of money for mental health. It adds some components for mental health as far as some background checks for those under the age of 21. Are you comfortable with those aspects, the expansion, sort of enhancing background checks for younger buyers, the federal funding for red flag laws and other kind of high risk laws that some I don't think Texas has one, but states that have those types of laws?
You know, I first looked at it when we were working through the framework. And like I said, I look forward to seeing the finalized text because the devil is in the details. I first looked at it and I go, how would this have helped stop the Uvalde incident? I start right there. And honestly, some of these extensive background checks for juveniles that had severe issues, this shooter didn't just wake up that day and decide to kill people. He had been disturbed for a very long time. So I think that's part of it. As far as red flag laws, I'm completely against red flag laws. And I'm grateful I live in a state that doesn't enforce red flag laws. This is what you won't see in this package. There are no federalized red flag laws. There are no bans on hardware. There are no bans on age limits. There are no universal background checks. So like I said, when you look at it, it's not really a gun bill. It's a mental health bill.
As you sort of travel through that community, is this something that you think will get support in your community, support from some of your House Republican colleagues?
I do. Like I said, as long as the Democrats don't get cute on the 11th hour and try to put a poison pill in there or something like that, I think that's what all of us up here are kind of mindful of. But if it remains the same, if the framework turns into the text, I think what you're going to see is many people can get behind supporting mental health. You know, I represent Texas 23, larger than 30 states, goes from San Antonio to El Paso. I have 119 cities or towns in my district. And the city of Uvalde over a year ago was asking me for mental health resources. You know, we were able to get $2 million for a mental health hospital, but that hospital cost $25 million. So, you know, a big package like this that really devotes resources, not only to just urban America, but to rural America, where we can get resources out, help our kids, honestly, help us too. A lot of people in America are dealing with mental health issues. We need to get rid of this stigma and we need to get ahead of the problem. And I think, you know, this package has the possibility of doing that.
I know you haven't been in Congress as long as some of your colleagues, but did this debate in this process, as it's been going on for the last few weeks, certainly since the tragedy at the elementary school in Uvalde, did this feel different? You know, gun control and responding to mass shootings has kind of been like a third rail for politics for a long time.
Yeah, you know, I hear that kind of phrase over and over. Did this feel different? I've never been involved in a mass shooting. This is the worst one in my state's history. This was absolutely horrendous for us, for me, for my community. And there was absolutely a sentiment to go, Tony, you have to do something. I don't know. We trust you to tell us what that something is. You have to do something. But I'd also argue, like in the House, we did nothing. I mean, we passed H.R. 7910, which I voted against. Democrats voted against this anti-gun bill, and it went nowhere. So, you know, in the House, it took a very partisan approach. I'm grateful, honestly, that the Senate took a different approach, that they got people, you know, they got 20 senators in a room and they work through a lot of the details. This isn't an easy topic to come to a conclusion on, but I appreciate the Senate's leadership on that. Hopefully the text holds up, and then in the House, you know, then we can get behind the bill and really push to get it over the finish line.
Do you think this is sort of the last word on these issues, or do you expect these pieces of legislation to maybe continue to move forward, these debates and conversations about best solutions to continue, even if and you know, we're not there yet, but even if this framework were to be signed into law?
We should 100% continue to have the conversation on making sure that our children are safe, period. Safe in school, safe in church, safe in general, right? And we need to look at all of the above approaches to do that. You know, hardening our schools, school safety, mental health, see what programs work, what programs don't work. We absolutely cannot do this. We can't go mission accomplished, give each other a high five and call it good because we you know, allocated some resources. We have to make sure and follow through because, I mean, our children are growing up in a completely different environment than we grew up in. And we got to realize that. We got to see if this works.
Let me finish with this a little bit different, but are you satisfied so far with this federal review of the Uvalde Police Department?
You know, I know these people personally. You know, I grew up 38 miles from Uvalde. I know many of these people before. I know many of these people afterwards. You know, there's a lot of things that could have went differently. There's a lot of things we need to find out the facts and shake everything out. But I mean, I worry that a lot of times in these investigations, they turn political very fast. And I have no interest in that. I have interest in finding out, you know, the facts and let the facts determine the outcome. So I'm just leery of that. You know, I want to make sure that all that gets shaken out, whether it's the state having the investigation, whether it's local investigation, federal investigation. I want to make sure that the facts lead us to a conclusion and not politics.
Appreciate that. Congressman, I appreciate your time. I know it has been a challenging time for you and the folks in your district, and my best to you and to them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to share one last thing.
Please.
I spoke with one of the fathers yesterday, and we've been working on a project here, and his daughter, Alithia, she wanted to be an artist. She was so proud of that. And we're working on and displaying her art here in the nation's capital. It's going to start in my office, but we're going to build it out from there. These are some of the things that the people back home are asking me to do. And we look forward to bringing her life, like continuing that moment there.
I look forward to seeing that in the Capitol as well, Congressman.
Thank you, sir.
As if we needed yet another reason to explain the current gasoline price crunch, truth be told, U.S. refinery capacity, or lack thereof, is another variable driving the current pain at the pump. It's been a problem for years, but now, with no end in sight to surging prices, experts are sounding the alarm, warning that under the current administration, not only is refining capacity likely to shrink, we may never see another new refinery built in this country again. Ever.
One of the things that happened over the last couple of years in this country is that gasoline prices were cheap because of the shale revolution.
Phil Flynn is one of the world's leading energy market analysts and a senior account executive at the Price Futures Group.
So everybody thought that refineries were, you know, suspendable, that you didn't really need them. They were dirty. Nobody wanted one in their backyard. And so the people in the refining industry had to be smart. You know, they can't build new refineries. So what they did was retool old refineries, just try to squeeze more blood out of the turnip. But you can only go so far. And the thing about the refining industry, it is so capital intensive. You've got to continue to feed a lot of money into these refineries to keep them working correctly. And with all the new regulations, with all the new taxes that they put on this industry, it makes it almost impossible for these industries to be profitable for a long period of time and to continue to make money.
Let me share a quote. This is from Chevron's CEO, a gentleman by the name of Mike Wirth. He said in a recent interview he doesn't believe another refinery will ever be built again in the U.S. He said, quote, there hasn't been one built here in this country since the 70s. And he says, I personally don't believe there'll be a new petroleum refinery ever built in this country again because The government believes there's a better way to go about it. Now, here's my argument for Mr. Wirth. Maybe the government does think that, but ultimately, day to day, for the folks at home, we need answers. We need help, to put it bluntly, Phil. I mean, we need some help here, and I would think it would be an all hands on deck, leave no stone unturned, if it means improving and increasing dramatically our energy footprint so as to bring down the cost and thereby also impact inflation. What do you think?
I agree with you, absolutely 100%. The problem is that the people in the Democratic Party don't, right? And people in the energy industry don't. And that's it. We have a disjointed energy policy. When we were under President Trump, for example, it was everything above energy. He wanted beautiful coal. Remember beautiful coal, and build up more refineries and build up more pipelines and make America energy great again, right? Mm-hmm, then sure. President Biden's like, no way, we don't want that. We want to shut down refineries. We want to shut down pipelines. We want to tell people, don't invest in these expensive refineries because they're dirty. We want to retool them to green energy refineries and make biofuels and things like that. So those mixed messages is the problem, right? The U.S. energy industry is like, hey, if you can guarantee me that I can stay open for business more than a year or two, I'll be happy to expand capacity and build more refineries. The problem is the government won't tell them that. In fact, our energy secretary, Jennifer Granholm, said this week, we want refiners to produce gasoline now. Well, how about 3 years from now? Well, no, we don't want them to do it. Well, you can't make those type of investments to make a product that's only going to be there for 3 years. It just doesn't make any sense.
Granholm, who, for example, has been invested in the EV industry, and that's a whole nother issue. Let me ask you something more broad about this particular topic. This is not a new issue. And as you pointed out, while the Trump administration did say, listen, all energy on deck, let's do it, more or less, to borrow a phrase from Sarah Palin, drill, baby, drill, they didn't get any refineries started. The administration before that certainly did not. And I'm just curious, if we're never going to build another one, how do we somewhat, for lack of a better description, how do we fix the problem? Because to me, it seems obvious right. That if you're never going to build another one, it's sort of like nuclear. We talk about nuclear power. If you're not building more, if you're not building newer, more efficient, better technology, how are we going to solve the problem?
I think what they were doing under the previous administration was expanding old refineries and putting, you know, trying to make them bigger. Okay. Building a new refinery, it was very difficult to get, you know, approval, really. I mean, because nobody wanted a refinery in their backyard. In fact, the push to build a new refinery really went back to the Bush era days, pre-shale, when we thought the world was running out of oil. And at that time, everybody was blaming the big oil companies, even the Democratic Party at that time, for not building more refineries. At that time, they didn't build enough. Well, then the shale revolution came and gas prices went down. Nobody thought about refineries. This is the problem. People take energy for granted when it's cheap. They assume that energy grows on trees. They don't understand the type of capital it takes to bring that gallon of gas to your gas station. But then when prices are high, they're all screaming, trying to point fingers, saying, boy, those evil oil companies or the oil refineries, they're driving up prices. The truth of the matter is that more than anything, bad energy policy really has driven up these prices.
Let me run a couple things by you then on that end. It's been suggested that energy companies are raking it in. Is that true? And if it is true, is there something that can be done about that? And I guess the second part of that would be, that notwithstanding, is there anything that we can do as consumers to apply the pressure on our government and as consumers to get these costs down? Because I don't mind telling you, it's one thing for you or for me to fill up a gas tank that costs $100. But for millions of American families, that's a non-starter, Phil.
It is for American families. And I, and that's why it gets me so angry you know, when I hear these energy policies about the energy transition, and it makes me gets me angry, because I understand what's going on in the energy industry. It's like, how do you plan to do this energy transition without it falling back on the backs of the poor and middle class? Sure, we can spend a lot of taxpayer dollars and send them to green energy companies and try to create these so-called green energy jobs that I'm still waiting to see develop, by the way. But at the same time, because of those policies, you reduce supply, you make supply more expensive, and we see what's happening. People are going to be hungry because they can't afford food. They can't afford gasoline. So this is absolutely gets me angry. And I think I got off your original question because I get angry. Sorry about that.
No, I understand.
I'm better now.
I'm with you. A lot of people are very upset.
Yeah. Well, and it is. And I think your original question, I believe, was, you know, something to the effect, about these energy policies. Listen, at the end of the day, when we talk about this green energy transition, who's making all the money on this? The money's going somewhere. Money always finds a place to go. We're seeing billions of dollars supposedly profitable to the energy companies, you know, record-breaking profits. People have to put that in perspective, you know, because for ExxonMobil, for example, I think they said that they had made, you know, what was it, 40 billion, something like that, 42 billion.
That's about right.
Yeah, but what they didn't tell you, or what President Biden didn't tell you, that's a record profit, 42 billion. It's like, yeah, but last year they had to invest almost as much to make that profit. Okay. Let me put this in perspective. Apple made $172 billion last year, you know, versus, you know, $50 billion. You know how much they had to invest to make their phones? You know, like 10, you know, just $10 billion, you know? So the energy company invested as much money as they made, where a company like Apple is making multi, you know, billions with no capital investment. I don't think Apple has to drill in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico to get a computer chip. It might be easier if it was that way, but, you know, these days. But I'm just saying, maybe Apple should be drilling for more oil, right? Because they have a lot more money than the oil companies. And the other thing is that when you look at these oil company profits, 2 years ago, they lost $50 billion. So they're just getting back to break even. And the other thing is that we're discouraging people from investing in oil and gas. You got the SEC looking through everybody's book. What's your carbon footprint? Are you invested in ExxonMobil? Shame, 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 shame. We're going to slap you on the hands. So that's constricting even more money in the industry, which is making it harder for these guys to produce oil. Yeah, their profits are going to be up. Prices are going to be up, you know, but at the same time, it's being caused by bad policy.
You mentioned bad policy. I want to run a few by you, and then you can sort of weigh in on this. And then I'm going to ask you for if there's a silver lining or perhaps a one solution recommendation that you might have. I'd love to have that from you, Phil, while we have this conversation going. Just some ideas of what's happened since the president took office back in 2021, January. The administration stopped issuing new permits for oil and gas leases, canceled federal drilling permits and new pipelines, canceled three oil and gas leases in Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico. You mentioned that. Also eliminated more than 1 million acres of potential drilling sites, and as has been widely reported, imposed an oil embargo on Russia, again, further constricting the available supply. Based on those policies, I mean, he's going to tell you, the president's going to tell you, Phil, it's Vladimir Putin's fault, it's Putin's fault, it's Putin's fault. Your reaction to that, and then last, if you can give me just a nugget or two of what you think we need to do as a country, as an administration even, to maybe make things a little bit better.
I want to talk to the American people and have them listen to what you just said about what President Biden did, right? You know, and he's out there saying it's Vladimir Putin's fault, it's the man in the moon's fault, he's blaming everybody, right? But you just gave a list. Name me one thing that you just said that would be conducive to lower gasoline prices or lower oil prices. You know basic, not one, no, absolutely. And to be honest with you, the list goes even further. You know, if we had another hour, I could go through more of the intricacies of the way they've delayed approvals, more bureaucratic red tape. And so I guess the answer to your question is take that list and reverse it. Every policy that President Biden put in place, reverse it. And you'll reverse the trend in oil. Back, you know, when President Biden was elected president, I wrote a piece, you know, the America just voted for higher energy prices. And I said every one of these policies would create an energy shortage. It would cause sharply higher prices. I was fact-checked by USA Today. Oh, no, that's not true. Well, guess what? It was true. And now we're seeing it. And those policies that you just mentioned are it. So the first step is to reverse those policies. You know, the bottom line is that the U.S. energy industry is not the enemy. You know, they're the solution. And yes, they will work to become more green, but we have to do it in a realistic way so it doesn't break the backs of the American people. And that's what's happening. The American people are bearing the brunt of President Biden's energy policy, and they're being hurt right now. So do America a favor, President Biden. Tell him you messed up. We've got to do a better plan. We'll reverse these policies until things get back to normal. And if he does that, I know that the prices in oil will start going in the right direction. One more thing. I know I'm talking too much. You get to talk too, but
no, you know, you're fine.
Kind of interesting because President Biden now reversed his policy. He's going to Saudi Arabia and the Middle East to call for more oil production. He said, well, I'm not talking about oil. Yes, I am. It's all about oil, right? Anyway, so, you know, he's been, you know, back in November, he was bashing OPEC. You know, you need to be producing more oil, and they didn't do it. So he released oil from the reserve. That was the first time he did it. Now, it's kind of funny. What do we hear now? Now he's going to OPEC or to the Middle East doing a tour. Guess who's calling for the U.S. to raise production? OPEC is putting the ball in President Biden's court. He says, listen, we've raised production over here. The low-hanging fruit is the U.S. shale industry. They're not raising production. So OPEC is now calling on the United States to raise oil production. And they have a point, don't they? Because, you know, because President Biden has been shutting down U.S. energy. OPEC is saying, hey, you want more oil production? The U.S. shale producers can do a lot more than they're doing, but of course, under Biden's policies, they can't. So I think it's kind of funny that OPEC is now calling out the Biden administration for restricting oil supply and driving up prices.
For those of us who lived through the 70s and the oil crunch and the Carter years, a lot of deja vu all over again, to quote the late, great Yogi Berra. Phil Flynn, what a wonderful conversation. Can't thank you enough for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much, and I hope the leisure suits don't come back like the 70s, too. I'm just saying.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, the Select Committee investigating last year's violent breach at the U.S. Capitol has now heard from officials inside the White House who say they told former President Trump there was no steal. I'll talk with congressional correspondent Chad Pergram about the hearings so far and what comes next. And Jessica Rosenthal previews the upcoming primary in Virginia and what they could potentially tell us about each party's direction for the upcoming midterms. Until then, I'm Jared Halpern. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in freefall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.